Welcome to the Caroline Gleick Show, where we talk about adventure and activism and how sports can change the world. In December 2021, my partner Rob and I are going to climb and ski Mount Vincent, which is the highest peak in Antarctica. For this trip, I'm highlighting leading women in climate science in Antarctica. In my research leading up to the trip, I was shocked to learn that women were banned from joining Antarctic scientific research expeditions until the 1960s in the US. And in the case of the British, it was 1984. While there have been gains made for women's equality in many walks of life, when you look at the highest levels, whether it's science or mountaineering or other industries, you still see an absence of women. My hope is, by highlighting climate scientists, we can continue to disrupt our notions of what a scientist looks like. Okay, well, I am so excited to be here for a new episode of the Caroline Gleick Show with Dr. Jennifer Kay. She is a climate scientist, and she is a member of the Protect Our Winters Science Alliance. And you are a professor at University of Colorado, correct?
Yep, here in Boulder, Colorado.
Well, thank you so much for joining me on the show, and I am super excited to catch up with you and hear more about you and your research. And so I thought I'd ask you to tell me more about yourself.
Sure. So I grew up in upstate New York. I love snow and all things cold, and now that's my job. I'm a professor at the University of Colorado, and I study climate and climate change with a focus on the polar regions.
And how did you get into climate science?
Oh, that's such a great question. Because when I was in school, like, this was just not as big a deal, you know, like there weren't classes on it where I went to college at that time. There are now. So really, it took, you know, me being in graduate school and kind of poking around and talking to some professors and realizing that, you know, not only do I love learning about things that are cold and glaciers and snow and clouds and ice, but that those things are really sensitive to our warming climate, and those things maybe will really change over my lifetime. And so that was 20 years ago, and here we are today, where all of those things that we talked about 20 years ago, that's what's happening right now. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, it's so depressing for me to see, like, I grew up in Minnesota, and so winter and cold was a way of life. And now to see that winter in Park City, Utah now is so mild, and I really miss that bitter cold and the ice and the days on end of being snowbound, you know, like those snow days we used to have as a kid. Are you seeing?
Yeah,
like, I really miss them. So what is your research like now? Like, what are you focused on?
So I work on a lot of different projects. I have a pretty big group here at the University of Colorado, four graduate students, two postdocs. So that's after you get your PhD, you kind of do a little apprenticeship before you kind of go on to, you know, maybe become a professor or researcher if you stay in the field. And so we work on a lot of things related to climate change and variability. So I can give some examples if that be of interest.
Yeah, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, so a recent PhD student was really focused on Arctic sea ice. So in the North Pole, South Pole, you know, when the oceans get cold enough, they freeze. And so that's called sea ice. And that change in the phase of the surface ocean can affect the cloud cover above it. So she was really looking at how clouds change with sea ice and how sea ice decline, because we're losing a lot of sea ice, especially in the Arctic, affects clouds.
And so what does kind of the research you're doing mean for the rest of the world, and especially for people that live in like coastal regions or people in the global south that maybe don't have the same intimate experiences that we do living through brutally cold winters and being huge lovers of snow and ice?
I think one of the main ways the polar regions can affect all of us is through sea level rise, right? So if you melt land-based ice, that ice goes into the ocean, and then that raises sea level. And so that, and also just the warming of the ocean, it expands as it gets warmer. Those are the two main drivers of sea level rise, which affects coastal communities around the planet.
Yeah. And so what else are you kind of seeing in terms of what's happening now with that and what we expect to see in the next like 10 years?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because 10 years is a timescale on which, like, we want to know what's going on and we want to see things. Like, you know, politicians have that timescale. You know, we can really see the next 10 years. There's a lot of variability in the climate system, though, and that's something that's really important to emphasize and think about. And on short timescales, you know, 10 years doesn't sound that short, but it is in terms of climate. Climate is often defined as a 30-year average. So there's going to be a lot of contributions from climate variability on those timescales. If we start thinking about what happens over the next 30 years, like that's when it's like the sign is just no longer in question. Like we're going to have less ice, we're going to get more warming. Like it kind of doesn't matter where you are. Like we start to see those signals of climate change emerge above the variability. So yeah, great question.
And so a lot of those like 30-year changes you're speaking to, that's kind of like already our fate. Is that right? Like from the carbon that's been emitted, or like how much can we influence through policy and through systemic change, like how much warming really happens?
Well, it really matters if we go above, you know, 400, 500 parts per million. I mean, some of the projections for CO2 equivalent at the end of the century are 1,000 parts per million. You know, that's 4 or 5 degrees of global warming. It's a lot of warming. So kind of the variability we were just talking about, it really doesn't matter on those timescales, right? Like the main thing that matters on those timescales is us. Like, what are we going to do? Are we going to put it all in the atmosphere, or are we going to stop? I mean, that's really the important thing on those timescales.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, what do you think that like an everyday person can do? Sorry, we're like just diving right into this. Like,
I love it. It's awesome.
What can everyday people do, you know, to help not only save the sea ice, but like save humanity? Because like I was talking with another friend of mine the other day, and she was like, you know, people always talk about saving the planet or the polar bears, but it's like, no, the planet's going to be fine. I mean, polar bears, they might not be okay, but we also need to talk about saving human life, because like literally with like sea level rise, people will die in these kinds of...
People are dying. Like look at New York City with the hurricane, you know, that came up, you know, from New Orleans, and all these people are in their basements in New York City. They issued the first extreme flood warning. And that was a warmer climate, more, you know, rain coming down and sea level rise too, because New York is so close to the sea level. You know, it's those things really come together in a pretty bad way for yeah. some locations.
Yeah, for sure. No, thanks for correcting me. And also with like the heat waves too, we've seen people dying. And so what can, I mean, yeah, I mean, I know that you're very involved with Protect Our Winters on the Science Alliance. And then what other kind of policy asks do you advise people to engage on?
Well, I think, you know, contacting your officials, whether that's your local government or your federal government, and just making sure that people know that you care about climate and, you know, voting for that too. Like one of the conversations that I thought was really interesting at the PAW retreat we went to together was about what the value of voting really is, like what that actually does. You know, maybe you have a meat-free Monday, but maybe the value of your vote is actually larger than a meat-free Monday. And how do you even compare those things? But both of those things are great things to do, and to also share and, you know, enhance your impact. Like one person's not going to stop climate change. This is something we all have to do together.
Yeah, it seems to me you're really well-versed on communicating climate science as well, because I know with some scientific research that there can be a bit of a disconnect between what happens in the research arena and then how it's communicated to impact public policy and for like mass communication. And I was just curious if you have any other tips for people about climate communication, because it seems to me that if the more we can talk about it to our friends and family, and the more that we can lead these conversations, the more impact we can have.
Yeah, I would say don't be scared to talk about it. I mean, that's the main thing. And, you know, you may say something, one statistic a little off. Like at the end of the day, that's not going to be what people remember. They're going to remember your passion for it and that you care about it and that you're worried about it. And, you know, climate change is a complicated topic. You know, like on a day-to-day basis, I just dive into my computer and just disconnect. Like I disconnect science from the impacts of the science that I'm talking about. And sometimes it's really emotional. It just hits you. You're just like, oh my gosh, like that species is going to go extinct. Like that island nation's going to be gone. And, you know, that is really hard sometimes. But I think those emotional stories can be a really good way to connect with people too. So.
How do you stay hopeful?
Oh my gosh. Well, working at a university is a great way to stay hopeful because you interact with students who are so inspired and motivated. They care about these issues. In my lecture last week, I was talking about aspects of climate change that are irreversible in human timescales, because I think those are important things to know, right? Like there's some things that we just really can't recover from and others that we can. And one of the students was like, nothing is irreversible. We can change it all. It's like, that's the attitude. Wow, that's awesome. Like that hope and that just like, we can work on this together and make this happen. I mean, I think that technology is really coming. And so it's becoming more and more about political will and our own motivation. And so hearing students so motivated, that gives me a lot of hope.
Yeah, that's great. I miss being a young, idealistic college student because now in my mid-30s, sometimes I get a little bit, I don't know, it's been a long pandemic and it's sometimes hard for me to stay hopeful and motivated. So I appreciate that so much. Another question I had for you as a leading woman of climate science research is, and part of this, I wanted to talk a little bit about my upcoming expedition to climb and ski Mount Vincent in Antarctica. And so as part of that trip, I'm going to be highlighting voices and stories about women climate scientists on my social media while I'm gone. Because as I was researching what's happening with climate science in Antarctica, I was shocked to learn that women weren't allowed to do climate science. In the U.S., they weren't allowed to go to Antarctica until the 60s, and the British did not allow women to join these Antarctic expeditions until about 1985. And Dr. Banwell, Ali Banwell, who I think you work with at University of Colorado Boulder, told me that. And I was really, I mean, I know that there are a lot of systemic barriers, but I didn't know that there were so many overt barriers for women's participation in that realm. And these are really recent. I mean, my mom is like her generation in a way. I know you do Arctic field work, not necessarily Antarctic, but what is the current scene like? And what kind of instances of gender bias have you experienced?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's a lot of perspective that like a single generation can see so much change, right? Like from our moms to us, right? Like my mom actually went to Antarctica as a part of her research as a scientist and probably in about the mid-1980s. So interesting. I hadn't realized and connected that with the UK thing. I would say now, field research is so much more accessible, but there are still some real struggles with it. There's a lot of discrimination and harassment, and there's been a lot more kind of awakening to that and the importance of kind of having safe protocols so that when women go into the field, they don't feel isolated or if something's happening, they have a way to reach out. And I would say that's not just, you know, women, that's, you know, we want everyone to feel safe in the field. And but women, I think, historically, you know, have had some challenging times in the field. And I certainly know friends and colleagues who've been through that, and it's really, really rough. I was talking with you earlier, remarking that when I was in grad school, I went to the Arctic for a month, and I was the only woman there for the whole month. And it just never, I was so naive. It never struck me that that could be a problem, right? Like that's, I mean, maybe that's good that I was that naive because I would have been freaked out about it. I remember my boyfriend at the time saying like, are you going to be okay? Like, you know, do you have a way to like talk to people? And I'm like, no, I trust these people. I should be good. But we shouldn't have to just trust people. Like there should be like lifelines for people who are doing field research and in those vulnerable situations. And I think, you know, technology really helps with that. Now we have satellite phones and other protocols in place so that if you're in a dangerous or, you know, unwelcoming environment, you have a way to communicate and potentially get out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've been the only woman in all men's courses and trips and things. And I've had good experiences and I've had a lot of bad experiences doing that in my realm of snow sports. And my upcoming trip to climb and ski in Antarctica, most of the other climbers and skiers will be men. And it's like sometimes having just one other woman on the trip, especially if she's in a leadership position, you know, because there also are certain women that have kind of adopted to the norms of masculinity. So if there's another woman who's aware and is welcoming and is like an ally, it can really change the tone At least that's what I've seen. If you just have like that one friend, it can make a big difference. So part of what I want to do with this series is to show other women of all ages that, you know, if you want to be a climate scientist or a mountaineer, like you can do it. And there's, yeah, I mean, I'm calling it breaking the ice ceiling because I'm so grateful. Love it. Well, and I'm so grateful to your mom and to you for really leading the charge with this. That's so cool that your mom went to Antarctica in the mid to late 80s.
Yeah. My mom is a scientist. And so I think that also, you know, in terms of barriers you're talking about, like, I never questioned myself as a scientist because I always saw that within my family. And so how do we make that accessible, you know, not just to, you know, families where it's like expected at the dinner table, like, did you do something cool with your science work today? You know, I definitely have students and people that I mentor that come from situations that are quite different than that. And so opening the doors.
Yeah.
How do we open the doors?
Right. Because sometimes it just takes that one person to kind of invite you in and show you and kind of like give you a little taste. And then you are like, oh, this is amazing. And yeah, to be that welcoming and inviting person into this world, I think that can really have a huge reverberating effect. It's cool to me that you did go on your month of Arctic fieldwork and you had a good experience. And so how did your teammates make the fieldwork more friendly and welcoming so that you didn't have any instances of feeling like excluded or harassed or just having that kind of hostile workplace environment?
You know, you mentioned having a buddy, like, you know, that you would feel more comfortable maybe if there was just one other woman or one other person. I think just one other person or two other people that really see eye to eye and see that, you know, the environment is going well, that really sets the tone, right? If you have two or three people who are setting an opposite tone, it can be really hard to break that, right?
Oh, yeah, especially if they're leaders.
Yep. So this was a very remote situation. There was, you know, maybe four or five people at a time. And throughout the month, like I was there the whole time, but some of the other researchers were going in and out. But I was really grateful actually for, you know, he's now a friend and colleague, but he's a lot older than me. I felt bigger, the age difference then than it does now. But Dave Turner, who is, you know, he was kind of like my buddy. You know, I really appreciated how he just watched out for me. And, you know, there were others too, but in particular, I just remember Dave, you know, checking in on me and making sure I was doing okay. And I really appreciated that.
That's so cool. Cause I feel like one of the things we don't really hear so much about in the realm of breaking the ice ceiling is men mentoring women. And I feel like that's often ignored, like space of how to make a more inclusive, friendly, welcoming, less hostile workplace is like men have a huge power to be like that ally and that person that sets the tone. And so I'm glad that you had that person, that Dave. He sounds like a great dude. And yeah, it can really just make a huge difference. So what else, when you were there for your month, where exactly in the Arctic were you? And yeah.
Yeah, we're on the coast of Alaska at a long-range radar site. So they set up a bunch of these sites during the Cold War to kind of monitor for Russian bombs. And so it was like, there's not a lot of infrastructure in the Arctic. And so, you know, when there's a place, a warm place where you can sleep and there's food, you know, we also went into Kuparik, which is a big oil and gas center up there. You're doing a lot of extraction in there. And that was also super interesting because I was the only woman in that situation too. So you go from like, you know, a situation where you're just like five scientists to like being a situation where you're like with, you know, 300 men all eating, you know, fajita night at the oil field. So yeah, lots of different environments. But yeah, coast of Alaska.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting because the crossover between oil and gas extraction and then these early, like those, I read a quote from a U.S. Navy admiral who was leading one of the Antarctic things for the U.S. in the 50s. And he said, women will come here over my dead body. And there was like this notion that like Antarctica was this like great white expanse and they would make the parallel between a virginal woman, you know, and it's like men's space to explore and conquer and like, you know, put their flag into the ice. And yeah, it's just those parallels are really interesting between how we conceptualize nature and women and how that has categorically kind of excluded women's participation in the past. And so, yeah, I'm so grateful for the work that you're doing and so stoked for your leadership in this space. So while you were on that trip, what are some of your tips for staying warm? Because I feel like I'm going to need this inside beta for my trip.
Well, so we were there in October. So it was actually a real time of transition. Like we saw the sea ice freeze. So the ocean froze by us, but it actually wasn't that cold. Like, I mean, I've experienced colder temperatures here in Colorado. Other times I've been up to the Arctic. I do some education outreach with Polar Bears International, which is the world's leading polar bear conservation organization. And they have a huge, you know, social media platform, and they also really connect with like teachers and classrooms and do a lot of awesome educational program. And, you know, like polar bears are an imperfect icon for climate. I get that, but they also do work. Like there's a lot of people who want to talk about polar bears. And so anyways, up there, we were definitely outside a lot more and in colder temperatures. So I would say, yeah, layering, you know, all this from skiing, like hot drinks, like anytime you can fill a thermos with something and have it to sip on, that's really, really good. Yeah, we had these huge like expedition jackets. I still have one. It's like a Canada Goose jacket. They gave it to us because they were like probably worried we weren't going to bring things that would keep us warm. And they're probably right. So good clothes.
Yeah. And yeah, the hot water is, I usually just do not a thermos, but just a clear kind of Nalgene and then just put it in my jacket anytime I'm hanging around camp. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of different tricks. I'm really into the hand warmers too. I've tried the battery ones, but I just like the old school little packets. Just, it's a lot easier not to deal with batteries. I feel like with tech and electronics, I'm just always charging. So
yeah. And batteries in the cold are also kind of a mess. Like they don't last as long.
So. You have to really protect those things. Like I need to design a sports bra with battery holders where I can shove them in because like they really have to be close to your body to stay warm. Like even in the outer pocket of your jacket.
Not good. No.
It's not good. Like I have a big Patagonia puffy that I'll be wearing, but it's just, yeah, it's, they got to be close to the skin and at night too. Okay. So what are you seeing now in your work? You told me earlier you're doing some, you do a lot of like satellite imaging. And so for Antarctica specifically, what kinds of things are you seeing there?
Yeah. So a lot of what I do is more like physical climate science. So what I'm trying to do is take, you know, data from satellites, like a spaceborne laser or a spaceborne radar, and turn that into like, what are the clouds doing? What are the precipitation doing? And obviously, you know, snow is really important for balancing the books of an ice sheet, right? Like snow accumulation is how you build one up, and how you lose ice is through melting and also, you know, icebergs calving off and things. So knowing where it snows and how much it snows sounds like maybe sort of a simple question, but it's not one we had a good answer for Antarctica. And in fact, some of the new data from spaceborne radars have been really helpful for characterizing just how often it snows. Basic questions.
Have you looked like at Vincent or this area that I'll be going at all? Like, is there anything you know about it and can help me prepare for like temps or anything like that?
I'm happy to do some more research for you, especially knowing like the exact time of year, because you're going like basically in summer, right?
Like, yeah, like we'll be there. Our dates, yeah, it's like the only 2 months people go to climb Vincent are December and January. And so we will fly from Punta Arenas to Union Glacier, and then from there we'll go to Vincent Base Camp on another small. But I mean, you don't have to, I don't want to like make you do a bunch
of like getting
work.
Into it. I'm like, but I'll do that later. But,
yeah. If there's anything else, like, I mean, in the past, like there was one expedition I did where I was going to try to do some ice core digging to bring back some high altitude ice samples. But then once I started to talk more to the scientist about the reality of that, of like doing this kind of digging to a meter deep at like 20,000 feet and how many extra Nalgene bottles I'd have to bring, I was like, I wanted to do it, but in reality, it's just, it's really hard to do that. So I'm excited to merge this adventure with some science component in a different way, because doing the actual science, it's like, it's hard to find something you could do as a light and fast adventurer.
Yeah. And also, I think, you know, this is a perception of polar research that I think it's important to kind of confront, right, like head on. Like, you know, a lot of what we do in polar research is not necessarily just go to the field and collect samples. There certainly is that, and it's very valuable. But the perspective that we get, you know, from satellites, from ice cores, you know, so you're not necessarily like looking at the ice or snow at the surface, but, you know, using a drill and going way back in deep time. And then also, you know, theoretical and modeling types of stuff. That's a really important way that we learn about, you know, how to balance the books of a glacier, because that's basically the question you're asking if you're trying to figure out how climate is going to affect glaciers or ice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we are going to get a little portable Bluetooth weather station that we're going to bring with us. So hopefully we can get some interesting data, at least maybe just for our own research, about what temperatures we're actually experiencing. Because I really wish we would have had that high up on Mount Everest or Chumbawamba. It would be cool to know, like, even just in our tent or when we're like getting up in the morning, to see how accurate our perception of the cold is versus the actual temperatures. And wind speed. Yeah.
I hope you get some sun, because I feel like in the polar regions, especially when it's cold, like sunlight just helps so much to keep you warm. So wear some black too.
Okay. Darker colors. Good to know. Good to know. Do you have any cool upcoming adventures, like on a personal level? Because I know you're an avid outdoors woman as well.
You know, it's funny. The pandemic started and I was actually on a ski trip here in Colorado. It was a 6-day trip. And at the beginning of it, I was like, oh, this pandemic, I don't know if this is going to happen. And we skied from Aspen to Vail. And the last day we skied down Vail, that was like, Vail shut the next day and we were on lockdown. And so it was like, wow, super intense. I haven't planned anything since that. And I'm sure there'll be a next adventure, but to be really honest, I'm just recovering. I'm just so happy to like put on pants and come to campus. Like, that's where I am right now. Like, and we'll see what the next adventure is.
I can totally relate, because honestly, getting ready for this trip, I'm like extra stressed, because there's a part of me that also just wants to nest. I mean, like, just wants to have a little bit more normalcy, although it has been hard for me with the pandemic. Like, it's been very isolating for me. I don't have a university to go to. I would love to have like more of an office or something now, because yeah, I just like sit and do a lot of computer work. It's weird how much it's changed my, like, I used to travel and do a lot more events and speaking engagements with people in real life, and now they're all virtual, and it's so weird to present to a virtual audience. At first I was like, this is great, but yeah, so it is quite stressful getting ready for the trip, but I know I'm so excited for when I'm there and we have no Wi-Fi. And it's just like, I feel like expeditions are a real chance to kind of like get back to your diurnal or like your circadian rhythms, or just like feel kind of normal again. I don't know. There's something about it for me with my personality type that's very comforting, where I'm like, this is what I'm meant to be doing. You know, I no longer feel like a polar bear in a zoo in a cage, but I'm like in the wild, feral line.
That is awesome. Well, unleash that and have some fun and be safe too, please.
Thank you so much. And I'd love to ski together sometime. So if you ever want to come to Park City or go make some turns in Colorado, that would be awesome. And what's the best way for folks and us to follow your work and communications?
Yeah, well, so I'm on Twitter at JenKCU. So it's JenKaycu. And then also, you know, you can Google me. I have a professional website through the university, and, you know, we put all of our science papers and, you know, some of the work we also do in education and outreach too. So, you know, I've been involved in putting together how the Arctic is changing for all different ages, you know, not only here at CU, but, you know, middle and high school teachers too. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, and have a great rest of your day.
Yeah, you too. Happy Friday.
Thanks. Bye.
I am resilient. I trust the movement. I negate the chaos. Uplift the negative. I'll show up at the table again and again and again. I'll close my mouth and learn to listen.
Special thanks to Avery Sandak for his help with the audio on today's episode, to my partner Rob Lee for being extra quiet while recording in the house today, and to Rising Appalachia for graciously providing the music for today's episode. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend and rate and review it so other people can find it. Until next time.